Сергей Шойгу сегодня.
Юрий Ковальчук выставил.
Нефти Игорь Сечин.
Бизнесмен Геннадий Тимченко может стать первым
замглавы администрации президента Вячеславу Володину.
Мэр Москвы Сергей Собянин накануне вечером. Российскую делегацию возглавляет премьер-министр Дмитрий Медведев своим европейским
коллегам. 10 men to rule the nation. Dozens of clans fighting for resources. One arbiter to settle disputes. It's gone by different names, from the collective Putin to Putin's Politburo. But most Kremlin watchers agree that Russia is not, in fact, governed by formal institutions like the Cabinet of Ministers or the State Duma, but rather by an informal collective leadership, with Vladimir Putin as its frontman and decider-in-chief. The respected political analyst Yevgeny Minchenko has been monitoring and analyzing the composition and dynamics of this informal ruling elite for years. And this week, his Minchenko Consulting Group released the latest update of their series, Putin's Politburo 2.0. The names have changed over the years, with new members being elevated to the Politburo and others expelled, but the structure has endured for more than a decade of Putin's rule. Can this shadow elite weather the current wave of turbulence battering Russia's political class? Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. With me in our studio in Prague is Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
And on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Welcome back, Sean.
Nice to talk to you guys again.
Sean, since your voice is traveling so far to join us, let's start with you. One thing that strikes me so much about this concept of the collective Putin is actually that this is really nothing new in Russian history. It seems to me that Russia's always, to some degree or another, always been ruled by some kind of collective. You can go back to the boyars in Muscovy. You can talk about Boris Yeltsin and his so-called family during the 90s. How is what we're seeing with Putin today similar, and how is it different than what we've seen historically in Russia?
Well, of course, there are a lot of similarities, and scholars who study these things are pointing these out. In fact, this form of rule where you have an elite that's split between interest groups and clans with a mediator and an arbiter on top represents a deep structure of Russian political rule that does go back to Muscovy in a lot of ways. The historian Alfred Rieber referred to Alexander II as the managerial tsar, a term I particularly like. As he moved forward in his great reforms, he had to balance various personalities, interest groups, clan groups. And one distinguishing thing about this is that ideology doesn't seem to really matter here in terms of what elites think in terms of big ideas. It's more about their proximity to the personality of the leader, and they gain their power through that personality. One of the distinct things, I think, in terms of the historical lineages of this is the fact that the elite seems to always be split. They form a collective block. They form cohesion when they're threatened from the outside, say from society. But there seems to be a lack of a kind of gentleman's agreement that governs disputes. One can make a comparison to elites, say, in Western Europe and the United States, where they may fight each other, but there seems to be rules of the game that governs, that they don't have to have an overarching arbiter or mediator to set in to balance these forces and make decisions and settle the disputes. The mediator in Russia seems to prevent this historical tendency of Russian elites to cannibalize each other. We see this throughout the history, in particular. I think the best example, of course, is in the Stalin period, where there's a lot of cannibalization going on. On my blog, I've described this tendency of the elite to not form a collective consciousness that puts forward its interests in Marxist terms. The Russian elite seems to be a class in itself, in the sense that it forms a distinguished social category, but it doesn't seem to be a class for itself, in the sense that it doesn't put forward their collective interests and allow for rules of the game to govern how those interests are put forward. Russian politics in this sense seems to remain a zero-sum game. You're either in it or out of it, and whether you're in or out depends on your proximity to the Tsar.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a look at who these members of the of what Menchenko calls Putin's Politburo. And one of the things he points out about this, it's interesting, one of the many ways this is different from the actual historical Politburo that existed, is that it never meets, right? I mean, some of these people aren't even in the country. And I'll get to that in a second. I mean, we have Medvedev, the prime minister, and we're going to talk about him a little bit more in the second half of today's program. Sergei Ivanov, the Kremlin chief of staff. Sergei Chemezov of Rostechnologie, who is in charge of arms procurement. Vyacheslav Volodin, who is the chief ideologist of the Kremlin, the deputy Kremlin chief of staff. Sergei Ivanov, the Kremlin chief of staff. Sergei Shoigu, the defense minister. Gennady Timchenko, a businessman who is a Russian-born Finnish citizen who lives in Geneva. And Yuri Kovalchuk, another businessman who's close to Putin. Sergei Sobyanin, the mayor of Moscow. And Igor Sechin, the CEO of Rosneft, of the state oil company. Kirill, what is your take on this? Do you agree pretty much with what Sean was saying about how this fits in historically?
As you know, I am strongly against any historical analogies.
We all know that.
And if we,
but this isn't really a historical analogy. This is just taking a look at
structural,
a structure.
Structural.
The Politburo is just a—it's just a heuristic. It's just a labeling.
It's a useful term, of course. And if we look at the Russian history from the so-called Boyars Duma. Боярская Дума, we'll see them representatives of prince families, prince dynasties, whose forefather is, half a mythological Rurik. So that was an aristocracy, and that was a part or maybe kind of result of unification of various Russian territories under the rule of one Tsar. Mm-hmm. And that was a reason, and that in this sense, the very existence of this Duma was reasonable, of course reasonable, and it disappeared after the Peter the First reforms. Mm-hmm. When we look at Politburo, we see various Politburos, different Politburos, because initially Politburo CK and Politburo Central Committee and Politburo was just a bureaucratic tool which Stalin used to establish his own rule over the party. Mm-hmm. And the role of Politburo till Khrushchev maybe was instrumental, just instrumental. But after Stalin, Politburo was becoming stronger, stronger, and stronger. And in the very end of the Soviet times, not in Gorbachev times, but in Chernenko and Andropov and late Brezhnev times, that was really a collective ruler of Soviet Union.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the reasons that was the case was because each member of the Politburo was representing some kind of institutional interest
in the
party.
He was in charge. Yes, he was in charge of something. Yes.
And we have a similar situation if you look at the composition, the nine members plus Putin. There's the 10 members. They're each representing some institutional interest.
I have an idea about this. This modern Politburo, if we can, if may call them this, is something between a board of directors of Russia and Mafia Circle.
Right, Russia Incorporated.
Yes, because on the one hand, it's of course it represents various fields of human activity. Mm-hmm. This is a chief of staff in Kremlin. This is a defense minister. This is several businessmen who are connected to the main important parts of Russian economy, oil and so on. And at the same time, there are people who have close connections to Putin. That's why I say that this is a mixture of board of directors and mafia, because the various attitude to combining them in this body.
They also have ties to some of them are what I like to call shareholders in the system. If you look at somebody like a Sechin or a Timchenko or a Chemezov, they're, I mean, Sechin, we're talking about the oil and gas sector, right? With Chemezov, we're talking about defense procurement. Some of them, Sergei Ivanov is representing the Silovoy Bloc, the security services. Some of them have functions to fill out. They're managers. They're not shareholders. If you look at somebody like Volodin, he's in charge of political management, of ideology, and he isn't really a stakeholder in terms of the resources of the system. The metaphor of a corporation or a mafia is a good one here. Sean, going back to you, I mean, looking at this, what Kirill and I have been discussing here in terms of the different functions and stakes each of these people have in various aspects of Russia Incorporated, if you will. Do you see parallels to that in the past as well?
Yeah, but I mean, I didn't talk about differences, and there are, of course, many. Yeah, we're not seeing a complete replication of the old boyar system of Muscovy, where the ties are based on family, blood, patrimonial estates. You see the interest group and clan system changing in the mid-19th century as Russia is modernizing. You get the forming of blocs and the forming of ties between different personalities based on economic interests, based on their institutional affiliations. But nevertheless, what kind of strikes me about the circles around Putin, if we look at it through in his entire reign, institutions seem not to really matter all that much. The focus seems the Minchenko report seems to suggest this, that, yeah, you have the coalescing of blocks, but really at the top, it's about personalities. It's about people who are close to Putin, people who are personally close to Putin, people who can provide certain services to him. And I think this is important to keep in mind. But one of the other differences I think that is worth thinking about is that the Soviet system of clans was also based on first a nomenklatura system that allowed people to rise through the ranks of the party. But it also, clans tended to have to burrow deep within the administrative system across institutional lines. So say a party grandee or a party commissar would have a patron client network that not only went through his institution, but also went through different party organizations all the way down often at the provincial level. Now, I don't know, and I think it's a question to think about these people who are individuals who are around Putin, how far do their networks burrow down into Russian society and the administrative system?
No, that's a good point, and that's something that Putin's Power Vertical, not my blog and podcast, but the real one, that's one of the things that was supposed to do. But as we've discussed in this podcast numerous times, that Power Vertical is fraying in various places, and that there is this almost this disconnect between this inner circle around Putin and the not just the society but the rest of the elite. And that leads me to something I wanted to have you both address, and that is that this collective Putin has pretty much remained the same. All the names, of course, haven't remained the same, but the structures remain the same throughout his entire rule, going back to 2000. But yet society in that time has changed in such a dramatic fashion. And can this method of rule survive in this kind of in these changing times? Kirill, what do you think?
I'm not a prophet, but
I know you're not. You're a very smart guy.
Thank you. I think that the essence of this power vertical changed dramatically for last, you know, several years, because initially power vertical was constructed as a long hierarchy of various, you know, powerful groups, institutions, and so on, from the very deep of Russian society mm-hmm. to heavens.
Right.
Yes. That was the idea, because vertical is something which is, you know, vertical to the from the top to the bottom. Yes, and that is the point. And now, if we'll go on with this metaphors, I see this collective Politburo as. Do you remember this book about Gulliver by Jonathan Swift?
Yes.
Do you remember this flying island Laputo?
Of course. Yeah.
And for me now, this Putin's Politburo is this Laputo.
Uh-huh.
It's very powerful because it's in the skies, somewhere in the skies. It's very high. But anyway, they first of all, it doesn't have any you know connections to the earth,
mm-hmm.
and secondly, the inhabitants of Laputo they don't have any idea about what's going on the earth, and mm-hmm. the second point is much more dangerous than the first point. And another one thing I'd like to mention. Did you notice that these members of collective Politburo, this collective Politburo consists of various businessmen? I don't know how successful they are in business terms.
I think Mr. Kovalchuk and Mr. Timchenko are very successful
in some sense, in some way. Yes. Okay. In this sense, okay. It consists of successful businessmen and failed managers.
Mm.
A head of Russian army. Which is in disastrous state.
Mm-hmm.
Ahead of, you know, president administration.
Shoigu's only been defense minister for a couple of months.
It's okay. It's okay. You know, it will go on. Then Volodin, who is ahead of presidential administration, who absolutely failed as a manager, who had to, you know, establish some kind of control over the society. He failed. Of course, we don't see, you know, such pre-revolutionary situation as it was 1 year ago, but the protests are still very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And the situation in Russia is still very tense. And then we'll see, you know, this so-called Prime Minister Medvedev.
Who we'll talk about in length in the second half.
And so... This is a very strange mixture of successful businessmen and failed political managers.
So your prognosis is that this form of rule does not have a future in this changing society?
In a long-term future, not.
Sean, what do you think?
I think it depends on how flexible Putin is going to be. And so far, in the last year or two, it's shown that he's become quite inflexible. The problem, as I see it, and this goes to Kirill's point about the division, them being up in the clouds and not really knowing what's going on in society, is that what's the mechanism for social mobility here? In the sense of how is Putin and his, or the collective Putin, going to bring in new men to break up the kind of people who've been at the top kind of sitting on their laurels? I mean, Shoigu could be one example of this. But one of the things that the party structure in the Soviet system did before the bureaucracy essentially took over in the 60s, late 60s and 70s, but in the Stalin period, it was incredibly dynamic, with violence, of course, but also with social promotion, of being the ability to recognize and see managers out in, say, the provinces and pluck them out and bring them into the center to shake things up. Without this kind of the network really penetrating into the administrative or the regional elite, the ability of Putin to do that seems to be quite limited, and therefore his ability to co-opt sections of society that can inject some dynamism into his governance is also limited.
Well, no, and this was something that, to his credit, Medvedev was trying to do. He was trying to replenish the elite with a younger cadre. Even Brezhnev, when we think of the geriatric Brezhnev elite, though, although any historian will knows that they spent a lot of time thinking about prepping the next generation to come up. And ironically, Gorbachev was the result of all of that. I want to go back to a point you made earlier, Sean, about the relationship between this informal structure and the formal structures. And I want to play a clip from Yevgeny Minchenko, who was interviewed by Dosh TV yesterday, about his report, where he's talking about what Putin's trying to do to kind of bridge the gap that right now exists between the Kremlin on one side and the Kremlin administration and the government on the other side. Let's listen to that clip and let's listen to what Minchenko had to say.
Essentially, Putin is trying to build an American-style system, where the president is also head of the cabinet. But the main problem is that it's not working today. He has built a system of two columns, which both depend on him, but don't communicate with each other very well.
So here, leaving aside the irony that Putin wants to build an American-style system in Russia, I think that would come to as a surprise.
Yeah, in some sense,
but
in this sense,
what he's
formally,
talking about,
right.
In terms of that the president is the formal head of the cabinet, which is the case in America.
Executive power,
yeah. But the interesting thing is this isn't working. The glue that's holding this together isn't working. For all the talk of how weak Medvedev's government is, how weak Medvedev is, how things are really being run out of the Kremlin, how there's a shadow government in the Kremlin who is really overlapping the functions of the nominal government, this doesn't appear to be working. Kirill, why?
I fully agree with Sean. This is because institutions, political administrative institutions in Russia, they mean nothing now. And that is the result of rise of so-called informal politics in 2000s. Because if you remember, Putin came to the power with the slogan, one of the slogans, not just to restore the order, but to construct the state mechanism, yeah. Proper state mechanism. Instead of this, he constructed a very strange building, which is absolutely based only on himself, and that is all. I'm not an architect, but I think that such buildings are not very stable, first of all. Secondly, if you want to, somehow to mix presidential administration or connect presidential administration with the government, you have to have a proper government with the real prerogatives and something in which it will be in charge. And as we see now, government is almost nothing. I didn't hear about several Russian ministers for months.
Yeah,
it's like they just don't exist. I listen about Shoigu because he is a head of very weak part of the Russian state mechanism, army, defense ministry. I hear about Medinsky because he is just a clone, right. And he is just playing his role very successfully. Because everyone is speaking about his not so clever initiatives in the cultural sphere, and I listen about Minister of Education Livanov, who proposed, I think, not so stupid reforms, but in the context of total stupidity and ineffectiveness of this government, I'm absolutely sure that all these reforms will fail. Mm-hmm.
You hear about Dvorkovich a bit, Arkady Dvorkovich, because of his battles with Igor Sechin.
Yes, but that is just a media story.
Right. Sean, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that a lot of these people are completely faceless to the public is an indication of how things kind of work here. And the Minchenko report actually puts forward an interesting contradiction in the sense that around this big government that coalesced around Vladimir Putin, you get the growth of his own personal influence. Therefore, all of the other players and institutions are atrophied as a result of that concentration of power and influence into his hands. The contradiction that Minchenko points out is that this has led to a slowing of the acceptance of any big strategic decisions, as well as implementing them of any quality. Therefore, the only way for Putin to say, if he really wants to replicate the American structure system, you have to decentralize power. You have to say, give Medvedev, you have a big agenda, right, that the collective Putin all is on board with. And then you have to delegate power to Medvedev and allow him to, rule over his bailiwick, certainly in line with Putin, but give him the power that he can crack heads and move things forward. As long as this isn't allowed, these institutions and these other players will never have any real power. And you can see this, I mean, you pointed this out, that the Duma is completely undermining Medvedev's government. They're just not listening to them. People are criticizing Medvedev's government from right and left. Now, in a sense, there's something very normal with criticizing a prime minister. But when you're criticizing a prime minister who really has no power to effectively do anything because he's not delegated that power in a real sense, this becomes a major problem.
I mean, what I'm hearing here, and it's you feel free to correct me if I'm wrong or contradict me, and I'm sure you both will, but I'm seeing success and failure here at the same time. Because this collective Putin, this Putin's 10 or Putin's 9 plus Putin, they've been very successful in amidst all this turbulence in preserving their own places in this structure that they themselves invented. But they have failed utterly at being able to do anything in terms of meaningful things in society. And we're talking about all these things like the social reforms that need to happen, the educational reform, Kirill, that you just mentioned. So you see a combination of success and failure. Would both of you agree with that? Kirill, why don't you go first?
I think that in a short term distance, you are absolutely right. Of course, from the point of view of this Politburo and Putin himself, they are very successful because they concentrate power in their hands, resources
and
they're quite safe in this position still.
Right.
But in a long distance, long-term distance, this is a very dangerous situation which could end up with a total disaster from the point of view of Russian state, of Russian society and Russian population. We can speak only from the point of view of 10 people and their circles and their, you know, aides and, you know, wives and families and so on. Yes, from the point of view of Russian society, that is very dangerous because, Russian authorities always accuse opposition that opposition is destroying, the state as a body, as a mechanism, yes, as an idea, Russian state. The only power which is really actually destroying Russian state today is these 9 people with Putin. Mm-hmm. Because they try to establish a system, or already established a system, which is based on the personal ties and their personal interest instead of state interest.
No, one of the things that I think is interesting, if you look, one of the things the Minchenko report does is it ranks, and I want to get to this in a second, the relative power of the different members of the collective Putin. And it's all there. You look at, you know, resources, you know, Silovoy resources, like, you know, financial resources and so on. But one of the key
looks
factors,
like Sudoku.
But one of the key factors is closeness to Putin. That is one of the key factors in this calculation of who's powerful and who's not. We've mentioned the term state here a couple of times. And in fact, the way I like to look at this structure, and I know if Mark Galeotti were here, he would agree with me, is that this is kind of like the executive committee of Russia's deep state. You know, if you follow the Turkish model of the deep state, which makes this is the executive committee of the deep state. But Kirill, as you have pointed out in the past, you have the deep state in Russia, but you also have the fake state.
Yes,
you know, the Duma,
yes.
The government, the ministers.
That is my favorite idea.
And there
yes.
is no there seems to be a disconnect between the deep state, which is Russia's de facto rulers, and the de jure rulers, which you consider a fake state. Sean, do you have anything to add there?
Yeah, I mean, just going back a bit to the idea of that Kirill was talking about, with the concentration of this power around basically 9 people, this government can only actuate technical or technocratic changes. It can't really implement big, big ideas like I think the development of the Far East, for example, or development of the big Moscow, or even the Sochi Olympics, because no one is in the position to have the power to take the big risks to move things forward because, A, it might mean their head, or, 2, they don't have the backing to move forward. So I think that really you're in the short term, you do get a lot of success on the part of this collective body. But in the long term, I agree with Kirill, it will not produce any big steps that are necessary to move Russia forward.
No,
right? I think they're...
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I think that's a good point, Sean. And actually, very recently, Mr. Serdyukov learned that, because for all his faults, Serdyukov was trying to reform the military with reforms that a lot of people think, that a lot of military experts, including military experts who have appeared on this podcast, believe are somewhat necessary. But he never got the backing to follow them through, even though Putin himself wanted the results of those reforms, right?
It wasn't. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah, and the fact is that what Kirill calls the fake state, which I actually quite like, really is hollow. It's completely hollow. I mean, here you have the Duma in its kind of antics, but everyone who has any position or influence knows that the real power lies next to Red Square. These other institutions are just, in a way, kind of forms without content.
All right. Well, we're going to continue this discussion in a few minutes and zero in on one member of the collective Putin, who's been the subject of persistent rumors of his imminent political demise. Gee, I wonder who that is. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. With me in the studio in Prague is Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service. And on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of the blog Sean's Russia Blog. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org. And you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
Макроэкономическая ситуация в России вполне устойчива. Экономический рост в прошлом году составил...
Wait, who's that talking? Kirill, do you recognize this? I'm not... Who is that?
Maybe Kudrin?
No, definitely not. Oh, it's Medvedev.
Medvedev?
Who's that? He used to be the head of Gazprom, right?
Sometimes.
Poor Medvedev.
It's a famous Russian beer.
Poor Medvedev. Over the New Year's holidays... Russia's state-run Channel 1 reportedly aired a comedy, I haven't seen it, in which the characters tried and failed to remember the name of their country's prime minister. That's not exactly subtle. But since leaving the Kremlin in May, Dmitry Medvedev has been something of a punchline as well as a punching bag. Rumors of his political death have been circulating persistently from almost the moment he became prime minister. The State Duma practically ignores every bill he sends there. Former ministers like Alexei Kudrin, German Greff, Anatoly Chubais publicly ridicule and belittle him. Vladimir Putin has rolled back most of his tepid reforms that Medvedev has enacted during his interim presidency. And his one lasting legislative legacy, taking Russia off wintertime, is also under attack.
Never touch Russian winters.
Never touch Russian winters. Napoleon learned that trick. And yet, despite all this, Medvedev remains. Kremlin watchers have offered various explanations that Medvedev is a convenient scapegoat for Putin, that firing him would be messy and set off a clan war over the prime minister's job, that Putin might be sticking to a deal the two made when they swapped jobs to keep Medvedev in his office for his entire term. Kirill, let's begin with you. How do you explain, A, both the persistent rumors of Medvedev's imminent political sacking, and B, his continued survival?
Well, first of all, I think, and I totally agree with you, that he is very useful for Putin today. He could play a role of a scapegoat sometimes, and I'm sure that he will play after, some serious problem. Mm-hmm. Which Putin couldn't, resolve and fix. Secondly, because of his image, this situation, bad and good cop, mm-hmm. in all these Hollywood movies and, of course, in Russian criminal mythology. But at the same time, we can speak about another pair, mythological, pair of political figures, a serious one, and the funny one. Right. So to be serious one and to survive as a serious figure, Putin needs some sort of a very funny figure of it's like in the Middle Ages when kings had how's it in English, shoot,
the jester. Sean, what do you think? Why has Medvedev seemed to survive? Is it because he's useful to Putin?
You know, this is a really difficult question to really answer. I mean, it's complete speculism. You can only speculate. You know, is he a scapegoat? Would his firing ignite a clan war? Is this part of a deal that they set when Medvedev voluntarily gave up the presidency? It's really, really hard to answer. But the question I have is that if Medvedev is so weak and such a joke, then why are so many people out to get him?
That's a good point.
I mean, one thing that you could say about Dmitry Medvedev is that he's a survivor. Yeah. You know, there have been rumors. These rumors have been going on forever. I mean, even when he was president. So the question I think we have to answer is okay, is this guy real? Because in the Minchenko report, he actually still puts Medvedev quite high.
Exactly. Not just high. He has him as the highest rated figure. And interestingly enough, Igor Sechin is the lowest rated figure in terms
So the question then becomes is, okay, if Medvedev is really that weak, why are so many people gunning for him? And two, then if we consider, okay, maybe he represents something else, what is the force that he represents that's so threatening?
Well, Sean, I bring this up all the time because I just always remember this, that when you wrote this on your blog, because I thought it was just spot on when you wrote it. It was during Medvedev's presidency. And you said that Medvedev and Putin were two parts of a Hegelian whole, that mm-hmm. you needed both of these elements in Russian society. And I want to take this opportunity. Can you expand on that a little bit? Like, because I thought it was a great point.
I mean, the idea is that you know, governance or rulers also depend on coalitions. And here we've, of course, been speaking about the coalition at the top. But I think we do have to say that the reason why these people still have power is that they do represent coalitions within society. They may be coalitions we don't like, but coalitions nonetheless. And it seems that Medvedev, despite all of his faults and despite his apparent weakness, he seems to represent, or at least stand at the head of, whether he knows it or not, of some coalition that maintains its allegiance to this system. I mean, you've spoken about this, or based on ideas about there's a certain percentage of the society that's still with the government, the 40-some%, and it's still kind of tentative. It's perhaps, if you get rid of Medvedev, you lose that. Because he symbolizes potential. He symbolizes the good cop. And not in a joking way, in a serious way. I just wonder if maybe we should start thinking of him seriously.
No, I've often argued that we need to take Medvedev seriously. I wrote on the blog, even though I just spent a little bit of time ridiculing him. I mean, I wrote on the blog that Medvedev, despite his weakness, or possibly because of it, his presidency kind of set the stage for the protests that we saw, because expectations and were raised, aspirations were teased about what could happen, that Russia could have a thaw and an opening up, and something that the liberal intelligentsia wants, something that the technocratic wing of the elite wants. There were a lot of people that wanted Medvedev to stay president. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of people in the elite who were deeply disappointed when he decided not to. Now, when the job swap came, when the famous castling move took place in September 2011, there were a lot of disappointed people, and a lot of people said at that time Medvedev wrote his political obituary on that day. But yet still here he is, still with us. And until they find somebody else to play that role, and maybe it's Kudrin, maybe it's Shoigu, I don't know. Until they find somebody else to fill that void. Now, I wanted to go to a clip from Minchenko, also in his Dosht interview, where he talked a little bit about Medvedev and why Medvedev is ranked number one in his power rankings of Putin's Politburo. Let's listen to what Yevgeny Minchenko had to say.
I think that Dmitry Medvedev is the number two person. There is no tandem, but among members of the Politburo, Medvedev is, of course, the most influential, not least because if, God forbid, something happened to Vladimir Putin, it would be the Prime Minister, Dmitry Medvedev, who would come to act as president.
So, I mean, what I hear Menchenko saying is what, I mean, the power of his office and where it is in the formal structure, is one of the main things that's giving Medvedev his power. But he ranks pretty high in terms of resources too. If you look at the chart, I mean, he is the head of the government, and the government does have resources at his disposal. So Medvedev can do things in terms of, maybe not do things in terms of policy, but he can do things in terms of politics. So maybe, Kirill, are we being too tough on the guy?
No, I'm not sure. I absolutely agree with Minchenko, but let's see. Medvedev, from my point of view, he's not a political figure. He's a function. And now this function is changed. Several years ago, his function, his role was to collect aspiration, hopes of some part of Russian population, and to make them not so dangerous for the regime itself. And that was his role, and he played his role successfully.
And perfectly. Yeah.
Perfectly.
He had me fooled.
Yes. Now his role is to collect their disappointment.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point.
Yes, to collect the disappointment, public disappointment with all the regime. It's very interesting when we are, you know, laughing at Medvedev, at the same time you are not laughing at Vladimir Putin. Mm-hmm. He's just diverting the attention from Putin to Medvedev. And that is very interesting.
He's Putin's straight man.
Yes, in some sense. Yes, in some sense. So I am not sure that Medvedev or Putin or Volodin ever read Guy Debord and his situationist, you know, all this works, but this is a real detournement of the, in the proper meaning of this word, of the attention of the society. Yes, we have kind of, you know, clone. Yeah. We have a clown, and we can laugh on it. Of course, this man could be very powerful, and his function is very, very serious. But what do you think about the seriousness of his function if even this Minchenko told that the main resource of his power and influence is that he, Medvedev, could be a substitute for Putin if something will happen?
Yeah, because if something does happen to Putin, he would be the president of the Russian Federation again.
So that's not about a man, that's not about political figure, it's a function. Mm-hmm. That was my point.
And your point is anybody can fill that function.
In some sense, yes.
Sean, could anybody fill that function?
But anybody isn't filling that function.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something to be said. Like I said, the fact that he is a survivor, Medvedev has shown that A, he's loyal, B, he knows his place. He doesn't seem to, I mean, the big question, of course, when he became president is he going to build his own patron-client network? Now, by all intents and purposes, he may have one, but it's not very strong and it's not very vocal. He has people, but it's not necessarily going against Putin. He's standing right next to the guy. And maybe Medvedev's presence might shed light on Putin's mentality in a different way, in the sense that Putin doesn't trust the other people around him. Medvedev perhaps functions as, you know, maybe as a good cop, as a bulwark force, because if he gets rid of him or Medvedev falls, then there's no hope that the Putin system has any liberal tendencies in it.
Yeah, he did bring people into the elite.
Sure.
One of the things I wrote about on the blog in the past is this so-called Siviliki, as opposed to the Siloviki. He brought in people who had backgrounds in the justice minister, as an example, in civil law. His old law school classmates, they all tended to be younger. They all tended to be more liberal. And this was his base of support inside the elite. These people are still there.
Right.
They're still there throughout the elite. And who knows, maybe Medvedev set a little time bomb that's going to, you know, go off in a few years' time. I don't know in terms of what, because these people are still in the elite. They haven't been purged.
So yeah. How this character from Blackadder series, you know, this British old TV series, servant Roderick or Bodrick, his slogan was, I have a cunning plan. So,
I knew you were going to be the cynic about this. But going back, I mean, if somebody else can fill that function, there are other people who could fill that function, but they're not. And one of the obvious person, and again, we've talked about it ad nauseum on this podcast, is Kudrin. Kudrin could fill that function, but sure. Kudrin wouldn't play the role this way because Kudrin's his own man.
He's a figure. He's a political figure. Real. He's not a function.
And yeah. He would take very seriously the role of collecting not the disappointment of that part of Russian society, but the aspirations of that, because he does kind of embody certainly that part, the aspirations of that part of the elite, and to a degree, the aspirations of that part of society. So it's a combination. I mean, Sean, would you agree it's a combination of Medvedev able to play this role because he plays it so weakly?
Yeah, I mean, if you just look at Kudrin's recent interview with Der Spiegel, he doesn't speak within the discourse. He speaks outside of it. He airs his disappointments. Mm-hmm. He certainly is, still close with Putin. He hasn't broke with the system that's been created. But he goes out and speaks frankly about the problems. And a lot of those problems are a challenge to the very structures that the shareholders and the people around Putin have created and solidified. Medvedev doesn't do this. He stays within his role very well, and he's not a loose cannon.
Well, I think what's very picking up on that, what's very interesting about Kudrin is he's always attacking Medvedev.
Yes, and that was yesterday in Davos.
It's really almost, it's personal at Medvedev, and Kudrin, it appears to me, has broken with the system, but hasn't broken with Putin.
Right.
And that's what's interesting. And Medvedev is the emblematic of the system, I guess. Remember, when Kudrin resigned, it was over a dispute with Medvedev, not with Putin. But what was ironic about that is that Kudrin is more in line with the part of the elite that Medvedev represented.
Yes, in some sense, but he's an economist, and he was in charge of financial field or area of Russian state, and this field couldn't be liberal or totalitarian. It's just finance.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he was so strong in this situation with Medvedev, because he was based on the real facts of financial situation and Russian budget and so on, and that is a source of his strength.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this particular situation, I'd bet on Kudrin, not on Medvedev.
No, if you want to go long term, I think in a lot of ways Russia's future lies with people like Kudrin, if not with Kudrin himself. The clock is ticking, and we're getting close to the end here. Before we wrap up, I want to ask you both one question. We've seen Medvedev in this Politburo and as the prime minister for a while now. How long do you think he'll last, and why? When does how much time does Medvedev have left, Kirill?
In my opinion, it will happen next year, 2014, and his failure will be connected to Sochi Olympic
Sochi
Games.
Olympics.
Because I'm absolutely sure that Russia partly will, fail, the preparations to this. Mm-hmm. So something will happen. Something will happen here. And the scapegoat for this situation will be Medvedev.
Sean?
I personally have no idea.
Neither
maybe Kirill is right, and Sochi will be the breaking point. But who knows? Medvedev could be the new version of Vladislav Molotov.
I mean, my personal feeling is that to fire the government is a big. It's a nuclear weapon, right? It's something you only use. You can use it.
That's
more than
why
one.
I mentioned
Yeltsin.
Sochi.
Yeltsin used it all the time, but it's something if you're a savvy president, you use it very, very sparingly. And I think Putin is going to save this for when he really, really needs it. And when, it might be a sharp drop in oil prices that wrecks the economy. And then you have Medvedev in reserve to take the blame. But I think the first time you get something of that magnitude, we'll know that it's a crisis that Putin took very, very seriously. when he finally sacks Medvedev, because I do agree Medvedev is comfortable for Putin. He's playing this role of the safety valve, even though a lot of people don't take him seriously. And that, unfortunately, is all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you've been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me in Prague has been my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service. And on the Skype line from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of the blog of Sean's Russia blog, which I recommend everybody read. Thanks for the great discussion, guys.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
I'd also like to thank our excellent producer, Tanya Koncheva, and I'd like to thank my indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rferl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.